Join us now for the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker today is Dr. Jim Berg, Dean of Students at BJU. The title of his message is, Why Does God Limit Us? The text is from Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1 through 14.
Ecclesiastes chapter 12. I'll give you just a moment to find it there. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Preached this message some years ago, and as I've been praying over what to deliver to you today, this message came back to my mind for several reasons. One, I'll tell you in just a moment, experience I had this summer while on vacation. But no book has, in the entire Bible, has had more profound influence on my life than Ecclesiastes. Back in 1995, I did a study for our singles group at Faith Baptist Church here in town. And I spent about 3 months studying this book, and it was a great, great blessing to me. And as I said, probably influenced me more than any other book in the Bible. I entitled the series that I preached, Secrets of the Good Life. If you want the whole thing, you can go to jimberg.com and download it. It's 13 sessions long, but I'll just give you an abbreviated portion of one of them this morning. This book was written by a man, as you know, Solomon, who at 18 was given a blank check on life. And God came to him and said, I'm giving you a blank check. What do you want on it? And Solomon said, I want wisdom. And God cashed the check, and Solomon became the wisest man that has ever lived, and without doubt, one of the most gifted men conceivable. This book was written at the end of Solomon's life. And I think the way it appears to me is that it is a testimony of his repentance. He's a man who had it all. And tried it all, and in the end realized that there was something that was missing in his life. God was not at the center. I don't believe this is a book of a cynic who is just despairing about life and so forth. We'll talk about that theme in just a minute. But it is, I believe, it's his repentance is one of the purposes of it. It's not an easily understood book, and I think that is because of its literary form. Many commentators believe that the literary form of this book is a cultural apologetic. Now, that's a big term, cultural apologetic. And as you know, Solomon was one of the he was considered a wise man, like Daniel was one of the wise men, and Chaldeans and soothsayers. Soothsayers are those who go around saying their sooths. And Solomon was one of these class of wise men, as was the Queen of Sheba, who came to test him with many questions, if you remember. I guess we could say, to be politically correct, she was a wise person. But there was this kind of interchange between worldviews during that day. And Solomon was one guy who did this kind of thing. And they often wrote each other little treaties about their worldview, and that is what a cultural apologetic is. It is a defense of their worldview. And I believe that this book is a defense of Solomon's worldview, a godly worldview, and it's written to a Gentile audience. Perhaps it's written to one Gentile believer, maybe a young philosopher in Solomon's court or in Jerusalem, and we have some hints of that back in chapters 11 and 12. But obviously written to Gentiles, there's no mention of Jehovah or Abraham or the covenants or anything that you would expect a Jew to be interested in. There were many, many Gentiles in Solomon's court at that day. Remember when he would marry a princess bride, she from Egypt, she wouldn't just pack a couple of suitcases and hop on a bus. She would bring a whole camel train of goods and servants and dietitians and manicurists and stable boys and everybody to take care of her enterprise there. And so at this time, Jerusalem is teeming with Gentiles, not only people of Solomon's court, but Solomon had made Jerusalem into a world trade center. So there are a lot of Gentiles, and this book has a lot of meaning to those as well. In fact, that I mentioned that it's a cultural apologetic. It is a discussion of this worldview. And that is why in Ecclesiastes 12:12, there is that statement of the making of many books. There is no end. It's a weariness to the flesh. That's speaking. Solomon is saying, look, we can talk about this all we want. We can exchange these books back and forth till we're weary in the flesh. But it boils down to this: fear God and keep his commandments. And it is, I believe, another statement that he sees this as that one of those cultural apologetics that he is sending to other places. Now, the key, I think, in understanding Ecclesiastes is in chapter 12. I want you to turn there. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And then we're going to come back to chapter 3. But I want you to see this. I believe that Ecclesiastes connects with the world through despair. And I'll make that point in just a moment. I was in Barnes & Noble on vacation. My wife was doing some shopping in the mall, and I decided to park in Barnes & Noble while she went and did that little exercise. And struck up a conversation with a man sitting next to me. And this happens almost invariably, whether I'm on an airplane or in a Barnes & Noble or someplace like that. Almost everybody you talk to, when you start really asking them about their life, most of them are despairing. Life is not going the way they thought life was going to go. And this fellow was he was a Gestalt therapist and about ready to retire in a couple of years, but really aimlessly wandering about. He'd been a Catholic most of his years, and then he had tried Seventh-day Adventism and there had really heard the gospel. But I don't believe had really accepted that gospel. And he left that, and now he was dabbling in some Wiccan groups and learning some things about them and seeing if there was some adventure there. And he had tried another Catholic order and taken on the name Elijah for himself and this kind of thing. But the point I'm trying to make is that this man is just wandering. There's so much despair in his life. And when I was able to make the points of the gospel and go back to the things that he had heard very clearly from a Seventh-day Adventist pastor who tried to lead him to the Lord, he began to realize, you know, I am wandering out there, and there is truth I need to grasp onto. Now, he didn't come to Christ at that time, but my point is, almost anybody that if you strike up a conversation with him and really get down to where their life is being lived, they are filled with despair. And Ecclesiastes tells us why. Chapter 12, verse 11 says, "The words of the wise or the conclusions of the thinking man." The conclusions of the thinking man are as goads. Now, remember what goads are? Goads are those long pointed sticks that a Palestinian farmer would use to get a slow moving oxen into passing gear. You know, his oxen isn't moving very fast or isn't moving at all. And he would take that goad and he would thrust it into the flank of the oxen, and the oxen would get the point. And he would do something. Well, Solomon is saying, I have filled these discussions. I am posing a lot of questions to help you think, what is the point, and to goad you into going a different direction than what you're going right now. And then it's also a book, he says, as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given by one shepherd. And the second thing you'll find in this book, you'll find many, many, many goads in Ecclesiastes, but a very few nails. Nails are statements of revelation. They're principles of life from God which anchor a person. The nails here are being spoken of are the tent stakes that would hold down the ropes, that would hold down the tents in those Bedouin deserts. And so Solomon is saying, I filled this book with goads and nails. And it's filled with goads. He will say, like in chapter 1, your life goes through all these cycles. Like the sun goes through its cycles, the water goes through its cycle, the water goes up and it comes down, back down, it goes around and around, and it keeps going around and around. You go around once and everybody forgets you. What's the point? And the point is, there isn't any point in life like that unless there's something that transcends your pointlessness in your life. Or he says, so what if you get rich and you gather all of this money together and you leave it to a fool who wastes it? What's the point of all of your effort? And the answer to that is, there is no point unless there's something about your life that transcends the pointlessness of life. Or he says, here's another one. You die and your dog dies and you both lie dead on the ground and you both turn to dust. What's the difference between the two of you? What's the point? And the point is, there isn't any difference or any point to all of that unless there's something in your life that transcends life that is not possible for a dog. And then we come to chapter 3, and that's where I want you to turn this morning. This is a familiar passage of Scripture to most of us. On and on through this book, Solomon goes lobbing philosophical grenades in the laps of these wise men and just explodes their worldview and saying, OK, you can try this and you can try that. But in the end, it's pointless. And he's trying to get them to think. And that's why he says the conclusions of the thinking man act as goads. If you really, really stop and think about your life the way you're living it, it goads you. It makes you realize there's no point in what I'm doing. And in chapter 3, he says, to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up. And on he goes. In interest of time, I'm not going to read all of them. But he comes down to verse 9 and he says, what profit or what's the point hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? Now, Solomon, again, is getting his philosophical counterparts to think. He says, all right, now think about life. You got all these 14 positive times, these 14 negative times, 14 minus 4, minus 14 is zero. What's the point of life? What profit is there in all of this? And he's goading them because he wants them to think, you know what? There isn't any profit. And Solomon is going to come and say the thing that does profit is if there's a God in the center of your life that transcends all of this. If that's not there, you turn to despair. By the way, folks, if you are asking any time in your life, you ask yourself the question, what's the point of that? You are being goaded by God to think about the way you're living your life right now. If you are hopeless, if you are despairing, if you are discouraged, when I deal with somebody who has just attempted to commit suicide and get an opportunity to talk with them, and I say, you know, you have come to the right conclusion. And I don't say this lightly or as we talk, but I bring this in. You've come to the right conclusion. Life lived the way you're living is not worth living. That is the right conclusion. The wrong solution to it, but it's the right conclusion. And if you are despairing and you are hopeless, you have reached the right conclusion that the way you are living is not worth living. And God is goading you as he is in these passages here. And there are several things. The point one I want you to see here that God is goading us with is the limitations of man in verses 1 to 13 here. You know, we have these times and we want to do something else, but another time comes along. And it seems like God is, in fact, in verse 11 at the very beginning, let's read verse 10. I have seen the travail or the task which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. God hath made everything beautiful or appropriate in his time. God chooses these times. And you know what? That puts some limitations on us, doesn't it? Because we would like to control things. And that's the first limitation that comes in. The first goad here is that God limits our control of life. If you think you have control over your life, just try to get your cat to come in at night. I mean, most of us don't have much control over anything. And the older you get, the more you realize you don't have much control over anything. You can't control the weather. You can't control the stock market or your health or relationships or accidents that come by. You really don't have much control over anything. I was talking just recently to a graduating senior, just graduated, and he's getting married and looking for a job. And he's realizing, you know what? And he's having a hard time getting a job in the area that he wants to be in. And he says, boy, you know, I thought it would be a whole lot easier than this. And he's thinking about that wife that he's going to marry in just a few weeks and realizing that life, really, so much of life is out of his control. And our common reaction, if we don't submit to God's sovereignty in all of these things, to his limitations, our common reaction is to argue and to control in some way, to argue, to manipulate, to push, to deceive, because we've got to get control back. And by the way, folks, every one of those things is a form of control. Deception, manipulation, arguing. All of those are a form of control, trying to take control over something which God has control. Instead of trusting, we try to control it. And our control, our faithless, godless control is shown by those kinds of things, by trying to control it ourselves. Not only does God limit our control of life, but secondly, God limits man's comprehension of life. Our ability to even understand what is happening in all of this. And that comes out in point B and or part B in verse 11. After he says he hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has set the world or eternity in their heart so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Now, here's an interesting thing. God puts in us this, he says, it puts this world, or better, this eternity in our hearts, this desire in us to understand the end from the beginning of all things. And we'd like to know the reasons. Why is this happening? Why do we have evil in the world? And why is this happening? And why did this happen to me? And it didn't happen to him. And why does so-and-so struggle? And so-and-so doesn't. And we want to know the end of all of these things. But God says, I put in you a desire to know the end from the beginning, but I haven't given you the ability to find out the end from the beginning. And you say, that's not fair. You know what? That God is saying something else here that we're going to get to in just a moment. But he is limiting your comprehension of life. You can't know everything about what, that you'd like to know. Say, well, if I just knew what was going on, if I just knew why God was doing this with giving mom cancer, if I just knew why so-and-so broke up with me, if I just knew why I can't get this class, if I just knew these things, I would be better. I would be more at peace. And if that's the kind of way you're thinking, you are being goaded by God. Well, I need more control, or at least I need more answers. Why does life seem like it has so many unsolved mysteries? I don't like unsolved mysteries. It's kind of like viewing the Grand Canyon. Just one, you know, you're looking at the Grand Canyon. I visited that thing for the first time about 5-6 years ago. That is a big ditch. Anybody seen that thing? That is a huge ditch. Amazing. I stood on top of that thing and just overwhelmed with the grandeur of that place. Now imagine, instead of taking in the sweeping panorama, which is what overwhelms you, you had a telescope and you could only look at the far rim. You could only look at anything you wanted to see in one square foot at a time. And, well, this is no fun. No, it wouldn't be any fun. But that's a lot of what God has done for us in life. We just get to look at little things. And we don't get to see the grand scope of everything except what he's talked about in his glory and how he's perfecting us into Christ-likeness. But we often don't see what connects this event with that event. And there's intentional mystery in that. Many times when there is mystery in life, we do the same thing in our spiritual lives that elementary kids, not that college kids would ever do this, but elementary kids do when something is hard to understand in a subject they're taking. I remember when my kids were in elementary school. And my oldest daughter is mathematically challenged as I am. And, you know, she just the first thing you do is attack the teacher. You know, well, the teacher shouldn't give us anything that hard. I mean, we haven't even had this. She's going too fast. You know, attack the teacher. If there's mystery in it, I mean, just attack the teacher or attack the subject. My oldest daughter at that time, she said she threw her pencil down on the table that evening when she was working on her homework. And she said, who needs numbers? Third grade. Who needs numbers? You know, attack the subject. I don't need this stuff. Why are they making me do this? I said, what do you want to be when you want to grow up? She said, I just want to be a mom. And I said, I picked her up and I took her into the kitchen and I opened my wife's cookbook and I said, do you see any numbers on that page? She said, yes. I said, what are you going to pay for all this stuff with? She said, checkbook. I pulled out a checkbook and I said, do you see any numbers in here? She said, yes. And I said, well, you better learn your numbers. We do need numbers. But when there's mystery, sometimes we attack the teacher, we attack God, we attack the subject, or we avoid the problem. Well, Mom, I can't go to school today. I'm really, really sick. And so we make up reasons why we don't have to face this kind of thing. Really, what we need to do is ask for help. If you're not getting your numbers, then say, Daddy, will you help me with my numbers? And you know what? That's the purpose of mystery, is to inject dependency and humility into our lives. God fills life with intentional mystery in order to teach us dependency, that we need God. Say, I don't like knowing, not knowing things. If you're in that condition, I just don't like not knowing this or that. Well, you're being goaded by God. You're supposed to be miserable if God is not in the picture more than that for you. You are being goaded by God. God limits our control of life. He limits our comprehension of life. And thirdly, in this passage, God limits our enjoyment of life. Look at verse 12 and 13. I know that there is no good or nothing better for them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Would you notice that last phrase? It is the gift of God. Did you know that enjoyment is the gift of God? Would you turn over to Ecclesiastes 5:19 real quickly? Same phrase. same emphasis here in this verse. Every man also to whom God hath given riches. Now, notice that God hath given riches. That's one gift. And wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God. So here it is. God is giving two gifts. He's giving the gift of riches and the gift of rejoicing. You know, some people, God gives riches, and they may be unsaved people, and maybe saved people. But he doesn't give them the gift of rejoicing. And if God doesn't give you the gift of rejoicing, your riches will not make you rejoice. They're both gifts. That's why I say one of the major themes of Ecclesiastes is life is supposed to taste like cardboard if you insist on eating the box. There is more to it than just this outward trapping. Or another theme of Ecclesiastes is you can collect all of your toys, but God dispenses the batteries. And without the batteries, your toys won't work. And you can try to get all the riches you want, but if God doesn't give you the gift of rejoicing, your riches won't do for you what you think they will do for you. And that's true of every other gift of life. And you know, there are other people who don't have the gift of riches, but God gives them the gift of rejoicing, and they're thrilled to have nothing. Do you know that's a gift of God, too? That contentment comes from that is a gift of God. It's a grace of God working in their hearts. And the teaching here is that life, the satisfaction in life, the enjoyment in life is not found in any one of its components, but in its creator. And if you leave the creator out of the picture, you're going to get goaded by the components of life. For example, let's say that there's a store called Empty Mart. And there's some stores in town that you might want to nickname that. Every time you go there, there isn't anything that you want. But you go into this, you got to see this ad that says satisfaction guaranteed, and come to Empty Mart. So you go to Empty Mart, and you start looking around in the materialism department, and you're walking around the aisles and looking for the satisfaction. Remember, satisfaction was guaranteed. And a clerk comes up and says, "What are you looking for?" And say, "I'm looking for satisfaction." She says, "Oh, we don't stock satisfaction in the materialism department." And he said, "Well, I thought right here it said." She said, "I know that's not true, but it got you in the store, didn't it? Worked." He said, "Well, I'm not leaving the store till I find some satisfaction. So I'm going to go to another department. So I'm going to go to the adventure and entertainment department." And so you wander around the aisles looking for satisfaction in that. And a clerk comes up and says, "Can I help you?" And you say, "Yeah, I'm looking for satisfaction." She says, "Oh, we don't stock satisfaction in the adventure and entertainment department." He said, "Well, I thought, but yeah, I know, but we don't stock it here." So I'm not leaving the store without it. I'm going to go try the power and prestige department. And you go looking through the shelves over that. And a clerk comes out and says, "Can I help you?" And you say, "Yeah, I'm looking for satisfaction in this power and prestige department." And she says, "We don't stock it here. You have to try another department." So you go over to the lust and sensuality department looking for your satisfaction. You know what? They don't stock it there. And they don't stock it in the friendship and the relationship department either. Did you know that satisfaction is not to be found in any of the components of life, but only in the creator of life? And if you try to find satisfaction in the components of life, you're going to be goaded and come up empty because it won't last and it won't work. And God says, "I'm the one who gives you the gift of rejoicing and the gift of enjoyment." These are the limitations of man. God limits our control. He limits our comprehension. He limits our enjoyment. Now, why does he do all of that? And this is the last thing in the last couple of minutes here. The lessons or the nails for man are verses 14 and 15 of chapter 3. Look at verse 14. "I know that whatever God doeth, it shall be forever," or it has an eternal purpose. Why does God limit life for us? To teach us eternity, that the answers aren't found in the present. I remember talking to a student some years ago. She came in one day really, really upset. And she was bitter about something, she overreacted to something in the resident hall, just a small thing. And she just exploded all over her roommates. And I talked to the supervisor and said, "I want to talk to that girl. Something else is eating her." So I talked to her and I said, "You know, your response was way out of proportion to the problem here. Something else is going on. I want to help you with that because you got to get that straightened out." She said, well, George Burns." And I said, "George Burns? Tell me about George Burns." She said, "Now, this is several years ago, and he was 99 at the time." She said, "He's still living." And he was a really ungodly man. And I said, "Okay, yeah, he is." And she said, "And my best friend's mom, who's the most godly Christian I know, God killed her with cancer at 40. That's not fair." And I said, "Where is your friend's mother living?" She said, "Well, she died." I said, No. Her body's in the grave, but she's living. Where's she living?" She said, "In heaven." I said, "When George Burns dies, where is he going?" She said, "Hell." And I said, "Well, how does it look now?" She kind of grinned. She said, "Pretty good." So I thought, I said, "Well, you know, don't have to take that much pleasure in George Burns perishing." But the point is, folks, the answer, the ultimate answer in things is not found in the present. It's found in eternity. And the last thing it teaches us here, verse 14, "I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it, and God doeth it, that men should fear before him." Why does God limit us? Not only to teach us eternity, but to teach us humility, that the answer isn't found in us. It's found in God. It's not found in the components of life. It's not found in anything we can do. It's found in what is going on between us and God. Young people, every limitation in life is designed to teach you eternity. And to teach you humility. We look at all of these things as impositions. And God says, no, look at them as your inadequacies that ought to drive you to the God that you ought to be dependent upon. Because you can collect all your toys, but if God is not at work in your toys, your toys aren't going to work. And maybe you're being goaded by God today. And there are some things that I'm just not coming. They're just not working right. And I'm not happy and I'm upset. Well, you're being goaded. Because you're looking at some component of life to provide your satisfaction instead of the God of heaven.
You've been listening to the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker was Dr. Jim Berg, Dean of Students at BJU. For a cassette or compact disc copy of today's message, send a check for $6 to Campus Store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, 29614. Be sure to mention the name of the speaker and today's date. The Chapel Hour has been sponsored by Bob Jones University.